You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Monday, August 21st, 2022. My name is Emma Vigeland, in for Sam Steeder, and this is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live from my apartment, steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Matthew Sewells, author of Icebergs, Zombies, and the Ultra Thin, Architecture and Capitalism in the 21st Century. Meanwhile, a federal judge says he is inclined to unseal parts of the probable cause affidavit used to search Mar-a-Lago because it's in the public interest, with redactions, of course. That process will be ongoing throughout the week. Lindsey Graham's testimony in the Georgia probe into election interference is on hold for now. A federal appeals court has temporarily held up the process. Daria Dugina, daughter of Putin ally right-wing nationalist Alexander Dugin, has been killed in a bombing. Both father and daughter had advocated for the Russian invasion of Ukraine for years. The DCCC is defending its decision to boost certain pro-Trump candidates, specifically John Gibbs, who defeated a Republican who voted to impeach Trump in Michigan in the primary, boosting them with donations in their election process. I'm mixed on it. Three cops in Arkansas have been suspended after a video went viral of them brutally beating a man, hitting him dozens of times, including in the head, as they pinned him down. In Texas, massive flash floods have hit the Dallas area as well as other parts of the state after a summer of record dryness and heat. Flooding has also devastated parts of South Asia over the weekend. Dozens are dead and thousands of homes are estimated to be damaged in Afghanistan. Across the border, Pakistan's former Prime Minister Imran Khan has been charged under the Anti-Terrorism Act after being ousted in a no-confidence vote, which he accused the U.S. of being behind. And lastly, tomorrow is Election Day in New York and Florida. So get out there and vote. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome to the show, everybody. As you can see, I am in my apartment now, doing the show from here. How's the connection been, Matt?
It's been great.
Good to hear. So if you hear a little weirdness with my mic, it's just not the normal mic that I'm usually using. I'm still testing positive. For people that don't know, I had COVID last week. I still do, I guess, even though the worst of it seems to be over. I was really down for the count. Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, I would say.
So still a real disease is what you're saying.
Yes. It felt really digital. But no.
She's joking, YouTube.
Yeah. No, it was just bizarre. I knew that it was really hard to get through, and I had internalized that through all of the media that I consumed and, of course, you know, reported on during that time period. But to experience it was a whole different thing. And I just know a lot of people who are getting hit hard now by this new variant.
Sorry to cut you off, but like people talk about the morbidity and it generally affecting you if you have different types of morbidities or you're elderly or something like that. But and obviously that's true in terms of like deaths and that sort of stuff. You see that. But there's also a complete crapshoot element to the disease as well, where, you know, Brandon Sutton was the first person I know that got it. He got it really hard. I got it pretty hard. My parents recently got it. and they had like mild sniffles. And it's and no, thank goodness, but you know, it's just weird how it goes like that. And I think that is a little bit underplayed by certain folks who want to say like, you're fine, just go out and get sick from this disease that we don't know like the long-term implications from.
Exactly. And like, honestly, if I did not have the flexibility to essentially be able to take last week off and, you know, even work from home today, it would be devastating if I was a gig worker or I didn't have some assurances from my boss and from the show. That would be terrible. I could lose my job in certain instances. There aren't protections against that right now. So,
You're at the point where they would tell you to go back to work.
Oh yeah. No,
even though you're like still like sort of coughing occasionally and, you know, sore throat and that sort of stuff.
Right. Exactly. So I will just say quickly that, I contemplated even saying this, but it was just too funny not to share. I was starting to get a little bit better. My fever, which was really high, had broken. And I asked my sister, because I was quarantining there because she'd had it recently, if I could have some of her edibles to abate my pain. And I usually have like the medicinal kind. but this was not that. It was from down the street. It was like a fruit by the foot bodega edible with sour candy coating on it. It just was so shoddily put together. And I threw up everywhere. Like, it was just not right. I think I had way too much. My body was just not ready for that. And I also looked up that gastrointestinal symptoms, if you have a really bad case, are sometimes part of COVID. So just variety of just grossness last week. But, you know, I'm on the mend. I'm on the mend, and it feels good, honestly. Kind of a slow news day, I would say. Bit of a slow news time in general. Although the raid of Mar-a-Lago kind of punctuated the typically sleepy August news cycle. Republicans have recycled and gone through a different, a number of responses as a way to justify.
Iterating and innovating.
Right. Yeah. They don't really know what to land on to defend Donald Trump here, because it's just so brazen and indefensible that he clearly took classified documents from the White House and was slow, if you're being generous, to return them back. So their new response is that release the affidavit that was used as the justification for the Mar-a-Lago raid. Now, you know, the practice is that an affidavit is not unsealed, usually, for almost, I can't even think of an instance, really, unless someone is charged. And that's a way to protect somebody if they're, you know, not, and they don't end up being charged, and also to protect the investigation if they do end up being charged. The process of the investigation is still ongoing. And so, like, I do think it's fair in this instance to say, okay, it's a special circumstance. This is a former president. It's pertaining to classified material that's in the public interest. I understand that. But Republicans want to release it for political purposes. So they can see this heavily redacted document with big black redacted parts and say, look, what are they hiding ahead of the midterms? But the federal judge here does say that he's inclined to unseal at least parts of it because of newsworthiness. I don't love that. I mean, I guess I'm mixed on it. I just think it could tip the Trump team off, even with the smallest amount of information, as to who's cooperating with the feds and chill, you know, potentially other witness involvement. But, you know, it's really peanuts in the end, because the investigation is the big white whale here. But in reality, this is all that Republicans have as a way to fight back against this. And they're struggling to defend it. And no one makes that more obvious than Dan Crenshaw here over the weekend on with Jake Tapper, he's like visibly nervous trying to defend Trump doesn't seem confident in his defense of the former president.
Why not just ask?
I thought they'd been negotiating and trying to get the information from him, and
he cooperated.
But he didn't turn over boxes and boxes of material, as far as the Justice Department says.
But he's been cooperating, and I think he's on the record saying, whatever you need from us, just ask. It's great to see you guys. I mean, it was a very friendly environment.
But his lawyer said they didn't have any more classified information, and the Justice Department said, yes, you do. And they went and got it. And the only reason we know about the raid was because Donald Trump announced it.
Right. Well, I think we would have figured it out even if he hadn't. But look, yes, the lawyers did sign the document, but they have nothing left. Now, that's either a huge mistake on part of the lawyers, but even if it was nefarious, again, why not say, hey, we don't believe you. Now let us come back and let's go through these boxes again. There's tons of boxes here. I mean, do any of us really believe that Donald Trump is like reading his nuclear secrets on his bedside at night? Like, there's an intent question here. And if you're...
I think that that intent question, that's the one smart thing about that, which is like, that is going to be the problem. Because it could be, what I have kind of figured is like, they're going to put the intent on some lower level figure and push this off on them, would be my prediction. Because the intent thing is always something hard to prove with this sort of thing. You've heard Ben Shapiro talk about like, Donald Trump isn't somebody who has intent. He's so, you know, I don't know what he's like, sociopathic. I don't know, like, an intentless figure. But that's why they talk about intent so much, is, and why Trump can't have it, is because that's what a lot of these issues are going to come down to.
Yeah, it's you know, you're not able to capture it. You can just kind of fearmonger about it, essentially. And of course, given the nature of the FBI, they're an easy vehicle for that kind of obfuscation. So that part, I think, is the most effective track that they could go down. But when he talks about how Trump has been cooperating, the whole point is that they came to him first and were working with the lawyers to retrieve the documents. And then he wasn't being cooperative. Just because you're talking to the feds and you're having an interaction with them doesn't mean that you're cooperating, and the evidence is obvious that he wasn't, because they found documents that he refused to return to them.
But I was cooperating with these other documents I gave you, and I guess what I'm saying is just a little bit, like, be nice about it.
It's a half cooperate. It's a half.
I said it was good to see you guys. I said thanks for coming. You're welcome anytime. It's good to see you. And you could have just said, oh, those ones? Oh, you want all of the boxes. Okay, well, you should have just said that.
Yeah, right. So, like, the timeline of this is that this has been over a year in the making. Like, I think the National Archives reached out to Trump or realized they were missing documents around May. And then finally, I think January is when the documents were retrieved, but they were very late, didn't give them all back. And then
I did cooperate with some of them, though.
Yeah, some of them were very good people. Some of them. And then, of course, in June, they also were trying to meet with Trump lawyers again, and they were still just kicking the can down the road because Trump wanted to hold on to these for whatever reason. I don't know if it's for sentimental purposes, if he wanted a memento from his time in office, or if he wanted to use that as some sort of blackmail or leverage or sale.
No, I would never. I would never think about that. It's because I'm a hoarder. I've been dealing with it for a long time. I'm working with a therapist, but I can't get rid of anything. I can't let it go.
And that's why I ripped up those documents. It was a way of purging. That's what my therapist told me.
It was a bit manic.
I mean, yeah. Plus the toilet thing. But that's for a whole, that's for another day. With that said, we're going to take a quick break, but first a word from our sponsors. If you're a business owner, the last thing you want to do this summer is sort through tons of unqualified candidates' resumes when you could be redoing your deck or relaxing in the pool. I would like to be doing either of those things. That's why you need ZipRecruiter to find great candidates. They do work for you. They'll work for you, I should say. And now you can try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/majority. ZipRecruiter, it uses its powerful technology to find and match the right candidates up with your job. You can easily review these recommended candidates and invite your top choices to apply. Majority Report has used ZipRecruiter in the past to find a great, great friend of the show and now still does work with us, Brendan, who is a super producer for quite a long time with us. Sam tells that story very well, but ZipRecruiter was a huge part of that. Additionally, ZipRecruiter has a complete suite of tools that make it easy to filter, review, and rate your candidates. 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. So soak up all the summer has to offer and let ZipRecruiter do the work. Ready for the URL? It is ZipRecruiter.com/majority. That's where you can try it for free. Free, F-R-E-E. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/M-A-J-O-R-I-T-Y. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. And lastly, 1 out of 3 Americans report being sleep deprived, and their sheets could be the problem. I know it was for me, my bedding for sure. Luckily, Cozy Earth provides the softest, most luxurious, and best temperature regulating sheets. I have the comforter. It's over there in my bedroom. I can speak to it, especially because I sleep really hot in the summer. Cozy Earth has been really just like a godsend. Cozy Earth has been featured on Oprah's Most Favorite Things list 4 years in a row. Made from super soft viscose from bamboo, Cozy Earth sheets breathe so you can sleep at the perfect temperature all year round. And with thousands of 5-star reviews, it's no wonder that Cozy Earth sheets have become the bedding of choice for interior designers and celebrities. Cozy Earth even offers a 100-night sleep trial, which means you have up to 100 nights to sleep on it, wash it, try it out. If you're not completely in love, just send it back for a full refund. There's a 10-year warranty on Cozy Earth sheets, and they come in 4 new colors. Now, I mentioned this before. I have a Cozy Earth comforter. It is so soft, and it is so light. Even in the winter, I like sleep hot. And so I got this when Cozy Earth became a sponsor, I got this comforter recently, and it really has gotten me through the summer, especially because my AC unit in my bedroom does not work super well. So it's been very helpful. For a limited time, save 35%. That's huge. On Cozy Earth bedding, go to cozyearth.com/majority and enter our special promo code majority at checkout to save 35% now. That's cozyearth.com/majority and be sure to enter majority at checkout for 35% off. Okay, we're going to take a quick break, but when we come back, we'll be joined by Matthew Sewells. We are back, and we are joined now by Matthew Sewells, associate professor, associate professor of architecture at the University of British Columbia and author of Icebergs, Zombies, and the Ultra-Thin Architecture and Capitalism in the 21st Century. Matthew, thanks so much for being here.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. It's great.
Of course. I'm really looking forward to our conversation. Let's start here. What makes the brand of 21st century capitalism that you use in your analysis specific to the 21st century?
It's a fantastic question. I think really it's the prominence, the dominant role, and in a way hegemony of finance capitalism. So, you know, you can think, of course, that capitalism changes over time. There's different phases, industrial capitalism, agricultural capitalism, consumer capitalism. I think capitalism in the 21st century is defined by a very prominent and strong rule of a unique mode of capitalism, which is finance capitalism.
Finance capitalism. And you talk about how architecture is a tool in that. Can you expand on that part of your analysis?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, obviously buildings, since the beginning of buildings, have always played multiple roles for humans. They provide shelter, they represent culture, but they always have a kind of relationship to money and wealth. One of the unique things, though, about finance capitalism is that finance capitalism is very focused on speculation, trying to find assets that speculative profits can be derived from. And as it turns out, real estate, the investment in land, buildings, and units within buildings, is a preferred destination of capital in search of speculative profits in the era of finance capitalism. So while we can say architecture's always had a relationship with money and therefore somehow capitalism, it has a unique and pronounced relationship in this current era.
So as opposed to functionality being the purpose of some sort of architecture, livability, right? Or even just beauty, right? Which you can associate with finance throughout history. This, the role of architecture in the 21st century as it relates to capitalism, finance capitalism, is a mode of wealth accumulation as opposed to a reflection of it.
Yeah. I think so. I mean, I think, you know, if we think of buildings always having, let's say, three primary roles, give you shelter, right? Culture, representing culture, and then relationship to money. I think it's that in the era of finance capitalism, the relationship to money has grown in prominence and started to kind of eclipse in some instances the shelter and the kind of culture quote unquote role. So of course buildings are still providing shelter, but that logic, the sheltering function is much less. So there's a kind of new functionality of buildings in a way, which is to function sometimes primarily as wealth storage devices and speculative devices. Yeah.
Yeah, and I mean that fits nicely into, right, your definition of the financialization of the economy, which is that wealth is accumulated not through trade, not through producing goods and going back and forth in that way, more traditional mode of wealth accumulation. It's made primarily and has exploded in the past few decades through investment, capital gains, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And now real estate, aka architecture, as you write about, has become a function of that.
Absolutely, 100%.
So let's then, you know, talk a bit about your inspiration for the book. You open your book talking about the 2008 financial crisis being central to your work on this. How did that inspire you to look further into architecture as a reflection of and a reproduction of capitalism in the 21st century?
Yeah, it's a great question. So, I mean, as we know, the 2007-2008 crisis had housing, subprime mortgages, right at the center of that crisis. And, you know, I was very interested in the years after the crisis, how, of course, many disciplines and kind of knowledge groups were spending a lot of time analyzing, dissecting, and trying to learn from the crisis, you know, economists, public policy people, so on and so forth. And I was intrigued that housing, which falls under a kind of disciplinary purview of architecture, that the discipline of architecture really wasn't playing that prominent a role in the conversation. So I was just like, huh, what if we looked at the crisis from an architectural perspective? What might be learned? So I set out on a kind of multi-year research project to look at kind of what was built, why it was built, and how it had kind of fallen apart around that 2007-2008 turning point in the countries and geographies where it was most pronounced. So Ireland with the ghost estates, Spain with all of their massive amount of building of housing that all sat empty, some of which still sits empty to this day. And then stuff that happened in kind of Florida and the American Southwest. So it was this kind of looking at the built environment and its radical transformation and its role around 2007, 2008 that kind of led to or was the beginning of the work that went into this book.
And that was just such a, I think, public facing example of real estate and architecture by extension being just completely foundational for our economy and the economy that we built on that. And, you know, it ended up burning so many people, really the people responsible for it, obviously. But let's talk about some of the identifiable features of finance capitalist architecture. I think you have like five prongs that I'd love to explore.
Yeah.
The first being creating spaces of crisis. What does that mean? And how are you able to see that reflected in society?
Yeah, it's great. So the more that built space is treated like an asset or as an asset, and then therefore something similar to a stock on a stock market, the more it is prone to the kind of rises and drops that are inherent to the capitalist economy, right? And the more money that's flowing into that kind of real estate asset environment with its ups and downs, the more, the greater the amplitude is of the kind of boom production and the collapse. So it is a kind of space that is more prone to instances of crises. Overbuilding, mass vacancy, and then the subsequent kind of social challenges. And so what we were just talking about, the kind of instances in Ireland and Spain are the most kind of some of the most extreme examples of this. But weirdly, you're starting to see a kind of simultaneity in many instances of booming and mass vacancies and kind of the semblance of crises. So these kind of ghost cities, for instance, in China, are an example of this, like huge speculative construction that is ongoing with like ongoing high degrees of vacancy. So this is the kind of example of the propensity of finance capitalist architecture for kind of ongoing space of crises.
I mean, here in Manhattan, the billionaire, or I'm actually in Brooklyn, but here in New York, in Manhattan at least, and also in downtown Brooklyn, we're seeing these huge luxury buildings being built at a rapid rate. But particularly, was it the Billionaires Row around Midtown, like 57th, 59th Street, is just littered with these luxury developments, and they look exactly as you describe, like these luxury apartments. They scream capitalism, and they fit into kind of the Midtown office space look, but they are apartments that are empty, really empty. Can you talk about that phenomenon more broadly in urban spaces?
Yeah, absolutely. So the phenomena of owned but empty, usually often condominium units. So these towers in Midtown Manhattan are condominiums. So they're an amazing example of built space being considered more as a place to store wealth and for its speculative possibilities than its use value, its inhabitability. So this owned but empty phenomena is a kind of like literally these are not so much for living in, they're for something else. This is a phenomena that is like hyper visible and hyper pronounced in Midtown Manhattan with these incredibly tall towers, but it is a phenomena that is happening in cities around the world. So it seems to be a dominant characteristic of contemporary urbanization, contemporary architecture, and contemporary capitalism. So you can find it in extreme forms in Vancouver, Toronto, London, Paris, so much so that, you know, cities are really trying to grapple with this kind of new form of vacancy and instituting all sorts of rules and regulations in some places that are meant to combat it. So, you know, Paris has, you know, a vacant home tax. Toronto, one is just coming into effect. Vancouver instituted one a few years ago, trying to figure out, like, saying, wait, what is this kind of new form of the city with all of these new buildings that are significantly empty? So so it's a prominent characteristic that really illustrates in stark terms the phenomena that's happening and cities and kind of people are trying to grapple with what it means.
At least in Europe, though, there already is some like existing public square, right, to a degree mm-hmm. where there mm-hmm. are, you know, the roads are not entirely built for the car. And you can have right. spaces and storefronts and little squares and areas where you can walk. There's no cars, like. There are, you can shop and things here in New York and in North America, I would guess more broadly, I know you've written a lot about Canada. I would guess that the problem is even more pronounced and also in its contributions to gentrification, if you could talk a bit about that.
Well, yeah.
Or I'm wrong. Maybe this is just me guessing, honestly.
Yeah. I mean, it's very interesting. I think, you know, there are a set of phenomena that you can really trace around the planet, because also let's recognize one of the unique characteristics of capitalism now, as opposed to 60 years ago, is that it has, it's supercharged globalized phenomena, like an incredible ease at which money can relatively move around the planet. We got to think it's also a relatively new phenomena that large numbers of ultra wealthy people can buy real estate in places all around the world mm-hmm. in large numbers. So you can really trace common phenomena from London to Paris to New York, but it's true what you say that because of the unique cultural contexts and histories and varying forms of kind of social welfare nets, that the differences, that there are important differences. So what happens in New York is slightly different than what happens in London, but I think one important thing to recognize is it's all about another common aspect of finance capitalist architecture, which is it's a means through which there's a greater division between the wealthy and the poor, right? So this is partly a story of gentrification, but and it related to its inverse, which is heightened poverty for large numbers of people, right? So the kind of empty towers in Midtown Manhattan are an extreme avatar that on its other side are empty or inhabited slums in Phnom Penh, right? So they're all interrelated. I mean, a fascinating thing that I write about in the book is a particular instance of a condo tower in Vancouver.
Yes.
That has a one-to-one home gifting program. And I think this kind of speaks to something your question's after, which is, so for every person who bought a condominium unit in this tower in Vancouver designed by the famous architect B.R.K. Ingalls, a single home was built for an impoverished family in Cambodia. And this is such a perverse illustration of the growing inequities that we're seeing unfold across the planet.
And didn't you say that there were even instances of condo owners in that Vancouver tower who would deliver the keys in is there anything grosser than that visual?
I know. So disturbing. So disturbing. And you know, and the folks who invented this one-to-one home gifting program are sort of on the record bragging about how this saved the developer in marketing expenses. You know, it was cheaper to build the homes over there and do this and get the press than it was to do a traditional kind of marketing route. Yeah, it's very disturbing. Yeah, so the ethical kind of acrobatics within the finance capitalist architectural phenomena are very disturbing and distressing. I mean, get back to the towers in New York. I mean, as has been widely reported, New York Times has done some great reporting on this, the sort of layers of secrecy in terms of who owns these units that are often empty is very, I mean, great lengths are gone to protect the identities of these buyers in many instances. And you kind of have to ask yourself, I mean, what kind of urbanity are we making where not only are the units empty, but their kind of ownership is cloaked in secrecy? That's, yeah.
And it is, I think, also when you mentioned London there too, New York and London being these finance capitals of the world, I think plays into both of their identities as maybe ways to hide some money in certain condos. And mm-hmm. I mean, I'm fascinated that the lengths to which maybe or the extent of which some of these properties are money laundering operations.
Yeah, it's a big dimension of it. It's not, you know, and for a while people would be like, oh, that's an aberration. That's something, but it's a major component of it in some places more than others. I mean, Panama City is a remarkable example of this. I mean, there's a huge amount of, again, condominiums and condominium towers, a huge amount that have been built in Panama City. And the way in which they play a role in a financial system around money laundering is very intriguing. By the way, condominium is a legal invention that hasn't existed for that long.
That was my next question, right? Like how that, can you talk a bit about what it means to own a condo as opposed to owning a home?
Yeah. It's very intriguing. I mean, so condominium is a legal invention that comes into being in the 1960s in America and Canada. And, but doesn't gain popularity until really the 1980s and forward, which, by the way, 1980s hinge point is really when the era of finance capitalism takes off. So there's a kind of interesting correlation, historically speaking, between the legal invention of condominium and the phenomena of financialization, finance capitalism. But prior to condominium laws, by the way, the first one was in Utah, and then it spread out from there, which is kind of interesting why it was in Utah. But prior to that, the only way for an individual or a family or a company to directly own a piece of building was for it to be connected directly to the ground. So you could own a single family home because it was on the ground. You own the land of the ground, of the lot, and then the home. You could own a townhome or a row house because, you know, you entered off the street, you own the land beneath it. You could own an entire rental building that was like 5 stories or 20 stories, but you couldn't own a unit on like the 12th floor or the 5th floor. So multi-unit housing was all rental housing or co-ops or social housing owned by the government. Co-op, though, you don't directly own the unit. You just own a share in the cooperative organization or company, and then you agree to use the unit. Okay, so what I'm getting to, though, is the condo law allowed for the first time an individual or a family or company to own a piece of real estate in the sky. So it's the first time it's disconnected from the ground. And this is kind of interesting. It has huge kind of spatial, urbanistic, and architectural ramifications. But my big argument is that it helps the asset function of that space because it disconnects it from the ground and makes it literally more liquid. There's a big story about liquidity in finance capitalist architecture. Finance capitalist architecture is seeking to create liquid asset architecture, and its disconnection from the ground is very helpful in that regard. Sorry for a long-winded answer, Emma.
No. I mean, it's fascinating because the proximity to it being liquid, and the most liquid you can get is cash, right? But this is way more liquid than, say, you know, dividends or investments that are tied up and you might not be able to withdraw your cash immediately. Like having a piece of real estate means that you're closer to being liquid than you would be in other modes of, I would say, and correct me if I'm wrong, speculative wealth management.
Well, the way I like to think of it is that, I mean, we can understand all assets on a liquidity spectrum, right? So, and at the most liquid end is cash, as you say. And historically speaking, real estate has been thought to be at the other end of the liquidity spectrum, right? Because it's attached to the ground. because it generally takes a lot of time to buy and sell it. You've got to do all this research, hire someone to do an appraisal, and all the different reasons. So in what I argue is that in the era of finance capitalism, a lot of effort is going into moving architecture and real estate down the spectrum to make it closer to cash. It can't get to, and closer to stocks, right? And it is a set of legal changes, invention of financial instruments, and kind of technologies of communication and kind of real estate technologies, alongside changes in architectural form and proportions and siting, that are all working together to move architecture down that liquidity spectrum, right? So, is a condominium unit on the 22nd floor of a building in downtown Miami way more liquid than a single family home in the suburbs of like Phoenix? I would say yes, because of its condominium formation and its position in the sky. And it's kind of hyper standardization, right? So, yeah.
Right. Well, so that is, I think, really fascinating from a, you know, speculative wealth storage perspective, which I believe is your next prong. But before we get to that, I just wanted to touch on, before we moved off the empty excess space of it all, how this plays in with commercial real estate right now, because we're in the middle of a pandemic. I have COVID, I know, but there is still like this push from a lot of companies to return to work, to get people back into these commercial real estate spaces, because they're essentially, I think my hypothesis is that the real estate industry is worried about it, the working from home becoming a new norm, and these mass commercial real estate spaces in these urban centers not being utilized. I think that could be driving a lot of it. Is that something that you're observing as well?
Yeah, it's a really, really interesting question. I mean, you know, I think at any given moment, there's so many different forces and kind of trajectories that are informing how we as humans inhabit the buildings and the cities that we're kind of within. And obviously the pandemic has applied a very unique set of kind of pressures and phenomena. So, and so you have different kind of interest groups, political interest groups, real estate interest groups, developers, so on and so forth, pushing and pulling in different ways. I mean, I would say that the most pronounced kind of sector of financialization in the built environment is in the housing sector. And interestingly, you know, the real estate market in housing is obviously like super accelerated and heated during the era of the pandemic. I mean, hype, partly driven by the ability to work anywhere, right? So on one end, you had an intensification of financialization and kind of real estate activity. And then in the commercial, this kind of deceleration. And now this kind of battle in a way playing out. So where exactly it goes, is a very complex question, and I'm not sure at this moment, but you're highlighting a really interesting kind of set of challenges and phenomena that are occurring right now.
Yeah, it's just I'm hearing too much about how we're in a commercial real estate bubble to not ask you that question a little bit, because I mean, obviously we're worried about the next crash because of all of this.
Yeah.
Insane, you know, well, let's now turn to your second prong about this functioning as speculative wealth storage. You touched on it a bit, but do you mind expanding on real estate as a speculative wealth container?
Yeah. I guess one aspect that we haven't spoken about is that one of the phenomena of the era of financialization is literally that there is a growing mass of money in the world, which is also a very simple but like kind of a remarkable thing. And many scholars have looked at this phenomenon. It's a widely documented and reported thing. And some people refer to it as the giant pool of money or the great wall of money. So you can imagine that, so, you know, since 1980, this kind of big wall or giant pool of money has been rising. And in the era of financialization, of course, you don't, like a good investor, which everyone is sort of told they must be on a personal level and also at a kind of larger culture level, you don't just let the money sit in a savings account. That would be not making the money work for you. So this giant pool of money needs somewhere to go. And then there's millions and millions of like expert, consultants trying to find places. So one of the places that all of that giant pool of money has gone into is into the real estate space, right? So there is literally this heightened pressure on the built environment to absorb this giant wall of money that is a kind of, in itself, a kind of product of financialization, which is interesting. There's a kind of feedback loops. So, and what happens is that you start to have the physical mutation of buildings to better serve this kind of surplus accumulation role. And so the title of my book, the first word is icebergs. So this is just one example, icebergs, which is for iceberg homes, that illustrates this kind of mutation that occurs when you have this pressure of all this great pool of money or giant pool of money needing to go somewhere. So iceberg homes are literally, I'm sure many of your listeners have heard of them because they've, you know, received lots of kind of press in recent years. But the phenomena of, a home that has a portion of it above ground, but a very large and significant portion of it beneath ground. I mean, we commonly think, well, if you're going to have a single family home or a townhome, most of it will be above ground, a very small part beneath ground. But what we started to see in London, in the post-2008 era, this is, you know, as things were really heating up, 2012, 2013, 14, 15, you had all this global capital going into the London real estate market as a place to speculatively store itself, right? And the architects associated with this phenomena had this kind of simple but remarkable realization. They were like, you know, there's all of these strict rules governing what we can do in these nice neighborhoods like Chelsea and Knightsbridge in London above ground. We can't do that much above ground because the preservation rules and regulations. But wait a minute, there's nothing governing at all what we can do beneath ground. You know, and there's a great quote with one of the architects involved. He's like, we looked at the rules and regulations and nothing was stopping us digging all the way to the underside of the planet. So, this wealth's pouring in, and it was like the existing townhomes and mansions just didn't have the capacity to store it all. And they build these amazing underground, you know, ballrooms, swimming rooms, theaters, just and in a way to kind of literally store the money. And then, of course, like the Midtown Manhattan towers that are largely empty, these also end up largely being empty. So you got to, you know, to kind of underscore what the function is, you know, it's like these, not like these underground theaters are full of the owners and all their friends watching, you know, the latest issue of this and that. So iceberg homes were most pronounced and sort of were sensational in London, but they're not restricted to London. You know, the phenomenon has kind of started to spread elsewhere for different, you know, Aspen has a whole phenomena of these things. Parts of Toronto are starting to have them. Vancouver, you're starting to see them. And that's one illustration of the sort of architectural extremities that occur when you're trying to absorb all of this money.
And I mean, it really is the personification, I guess, or the physical manifestation of space as money and buying up space as a way to accumulate capital and reproduce it. And, you know, we've talked a lot on this program about the loss of public spaces, how Starbucks, you know, offering their bathrooms to homeless people is their PR exercise. But in reality, it's because where else can people go without any public spaces? I mean, and I see a lot of your work and what you've identified here is a mass contributor to that. I want to get to the part where you talk a bit about the identifiable physical characteristics outside of that extreme example of like the iceberg homes when, how the, especially with these tall, thin towers, right? Or these corporate glossy looking condominium complexes in urban spaces in particular, but also in other areas, as being very standardized, but also architecturally, unique and sexy in a way, but at the same time, the units look very similar. There, you can put a dollar figure probably in terms of an appraisal on what a condominium unit would look like in one of these buildings fairly easily. So that part is fascinating to me. Can you talk a bit about that?
Yeah, yeah. It's a really great question. So I mentioned that this desire for assets to architectural assets to become more liquid, to move down that liquidity spectrum. So one thing that helps that occur is a high degree of standardization, because, you know, historically, you know, every building being different with its own very unique characters meant that a potential buyer would have to do all this kind of effort and work to understand its uniqueness. The more it's standardized, the more that kind of work is reduced. And therefore, in its absence, the asset becomes more liquid. So liquidity is related to spatial standardization. You know, to be very literal about this, one US dollar bill is like every one US dollar bill. You don't have to like analyze it and be like, oh my God. So the closer an architectural thing becomes to the dollar bill, the more, I mean, we could say that that is standardized and therefore liquid. Interestingly, so what there is a kind of spatial financial ecology in a way, where standardization though is often accompanied by a version of iconicity, and the iconicity serves a role to kind of as almost advertising the standardized assets, right? So it's like, it's like, how can we give you something that is very liquid and standardized and will help your investment portfolio?
It's branding.
Exactly.
You know, yeah. Am I going to go to JP Morgan, or am I going to go to
exactly.
Deutsche Bank. Yeah.
Exactly. So, and sometimes the iconicity is in a building that is like literally like super iconic. Let's call it a museum, and that it is placed in close proximity to a bunch of super standardized condominium units. And there, it's almost that the museum is understood in this sort of spatio-financial ecology as drawing people in through the branding, that, and then to seed the adjacent area with investment desire. Now, in urban planning and urban design circles, people have made a big deal out of what is called the Bilbao effect. And this, and so that was all to describe the phenomena that happened when Frank Gehry designed the Bilbao Museum, the Guggenheim Museum, brand new in Bilbao, Spain. And the Bilbao effect came to be seen as like, oh my God, the design and construction of this like eye-catching, super weird, iconic building totally transformed the city and made it way better. But when you really look at it, it's like, how did it transform the city and how did it make it way better? It had a lot to do with increasing its international profile and a place that became a magnet for heightened real estate investment. That's a big part of what the Bilbao effect is. It raised real estate values, it made the developers wealthier, and it raised tax revenues and made the city be perceived into a greater success. So cities around the world have wanted their own Bilbao effect. I would argue that the Bilbao effect is literally a kind of example of the role of architectural iconicity to raise the real estate values in a city in relatively standardized products. Now, sometimes the thing that is iconic is weirdly exactly the same thing that's standardized. And it's intriguing, right? Like, so I, in my book, as an example, I use 56 Leonard in Tribeca, in Manhattan, in Tribeca, which...
Oh my God, that building is a terrible eyesore. People should look it up.
Yeah. So it's a super tall condominium tower that becomes kind of pixelated, is the word that some people use, like fragmented as it rises to the top. So it's literally these sort of very standardized spatial boxes that has attracted investors and buyers from all around the world, incredibly expensive. But in the offsetting of them is very atypical and is iconic. So it's a sort of using standard, hyper-standardized increments that are offset to create iconicity. So it's very interesting how these architectural, I mean, it literally is a spatial and aesthetic operation.
Yeah, or the needle building here in New York too, the incredibly tall and thin tower is another great example of that. Is that what it's called?
I think, are you referring to the one on 111 West 57?
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. And then, you know, that building's unbelievable. I mean, it is.
How many units in that are actually being used? I mean, one, I've heard it sways in the wind.
Yeah.
I've heard it's so tall that it sways in the wind. Come on, that thing is just built for the dynamic that you describe.
I think, yeah, absolutely, absolutely. I mean, you know, it's a good question how many units are being used. You know, it's all of these things are cloaked in such secrecy, and there's all this effort to kind of obscure. It's really hard to find out. You have to do all this kind of cloak and dagger to figure out exactly how many units are being used in there. I find it so amazing. I mean, that literally is one of the tallest buildings in the world. I mean, it's incredibly tall, and it only has like 56 units, or I can't remember the exact number, but it's just remarkable. All the units in there are one entire floor, or two or three floors. So they're literally like this kind. It's like this suburban form of urbanism, right? Like it's like a single family house in the center of the city, but isolated in the sky, which by the way, I think is back to this question of liquidity, is another example of the kind of, like the very proportionality of thinness, I think is something that helps achieve liquidity.
Can you expand on that? And I know we might have to let you go. I just have a few more questions for you because this is fascinating to me.
Yeah. Okay. Like, well, let's go back to, if you think that multi-unit housing buildings can take any form, like they can be four stories tall, they can be courtyard buildings, so on and so forth. I mean, you really have to ask ourselves, like, why, what is it that's driving people to build these super slender things where there's an elevator that just deposits you in your unit. And I think let's just go on the elevator depositing in your unit in comparison to like a six-story building with a hallway. The hallway is a place where you can potentially bump into your neighbors, right?
Oh, and God forbid.
God forbid. And let's imagine that, like, I happen to live in a building that has an exterior circulation system, you know? And, like, so you can, the richness of the social interactions in the building, I'm always bumping into my neighbors because you can sort of see from level up. So this is an example of heightened interactivity. Now, the antithesis is this tall, slender tower that deposits you in your unit. Gone is even the possibility of bumping into your neighbor. Now, I think that literally that logic of like never bumping into your neighbor also helps the liquidity because the bumping into the neighbor is another form of local specificity. that kind of demands like knowledge about and kind of labor associated with it. And to eliminate that produces this heightened degree of frictionless social being. So social disentanglement is another story of finance capitalist architecture. And to kind of disentangle the possibilities of interaction is a big component of this. And so circulation routes, how an elevator is placed, all of these are very literally employed, I think, in this overall logic. And it's these super thin towers in Midtown Manhattan are a kind of extreme example of this. But actually, when you see it in sharp relief there, you can find it in much less extreme forms in building practices all around the world. It's not only in these big towers, actually. The big towers help us see the phenomena of social disentanglement related to financialization in more subtle forms that are happening everywhere.
Well, I mean, it's with these units as a methods that one in terms of wealth transfer and also to undercut public spaces, like the fact that that is what in function it is actually doing. The fact that it is replicated in the way that like the elevator units and the condominium units are constructed. I mean, that's central to your book, but it's also poetic in this dark way. I'm wondering what you think about Airbnb and how that fits into all of this. And like just the notion of renting, anyone can be a landlord. You can be a landlord too. we played, I think a few months ago, this TikTok of all of these young finance bro types straight out of The Big Short bragging about mm-hmm. how many rental properties they own in the hundreds and mm-hmm. how much mm-hmm. how much passive income they're leeching off of the rest of the world. Mm-hmm. I mean, that is, in the way that the gig economy has transformed and undercut really taxi services, taxi driver unions, that kind of thing, via tech ease. Airbnb seems to be doing the same kind of thing, except this time with real estate.
Yeah, it's a great question. I think it plays a big and important role. I think the whole phenomena of, I mean, you know, there's sort of different technological thrusts, right? So fintech, like financial technologies, huge amount of investment and innovation happening in that space that is a very interesting thing to kind of talk about in relation to financialization, the technological dimension. And then as part of that is a kind of another subset of the technological thrust, which is referred to as prop tech, property technology. And, you know, so even something like Zillow, I mean, when we really think, like, what is the role of Zillow in moving things along that liquidity spectrum? Like, some of these things are very subtle but profound, right? Like, think of, like, the ease at which to explore properties around
and also, like the liquid dollar figure is right there if you're exploring.
Totally. Yeah. Instantaneous mortgage pre-approval. Anyway, so something like Zillow, so the prop tech, but the most famous property technology out there, I think, is and most disruptive is Airbnb. So alongside Zillow, something like Airbnb. I guess why I'm bringing Zillow up, I think it's interesting to think of all of these in a kind of a connected techno milieu that is all playing a role in financialization. But yes, absolutely. Airbnb has radically changed how many, many people relate to the pieces of architecture, the pieces of buildings or buildings that they live in, purchase or not live in. And in this kind of shift to seeing them pieces of architecture more and more as assets and tools to speculate upon and to derive wealth from, there's no question that Airbnb has really accelerated this. The ability for people to be like, okay, you know, I can't afford this property based on my assets and income right now, but I can easily incorporate into my kind of spreadsheet the ability to rent out this suite for portions of the time when I'm here, and therefore, and I can show this to the lender and therefore afford something that I couldn't otherwise afford.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but is that a commonplace thing now as a way, like you can say in your application for a mortgage that you're going to put part of your unit up for Airbnb, and that is seen as like a new income source for people seeking more?
Absolutely.
I mean, that seems really, really dodgy. And like we maybe should have learned a lesson or two from 15 years ago that this is what we're granting mortgages based on. That's crazy.
Yeah, no, these things are absolutely can be taken into consideration with lenders for sure. You know? Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So it's, and then, I mean, fascinating all these kind of literal changes in way buildings are inhabited, right? These kind of, you know, like people living, it's like that I can't afford this house at all, but I can do it with the thing that I just described, but I'm going to, like, me and my partner are going to live in the driveway in an Airstream trailer and rent the entire house out. And once the financial dynamics shift a little bit, we'll stop, you know, and endless numbers of permutations. So it's affecting how people are buying, why they are buying, and then literally how they are inhabiting and using their space, and in some cases also physically building their spaces. I mean, things are more built to accommodate these kind of phenomena now.
So my last question really is based on the usage of these units, architecture, real estate, as a mode of wealth accumulation, even though it appears a bit different than it did in 2007, the precariousness is still there, except it's just manifesting itself in a little bit of a different way. What is your opinion on the real estate market right now as it relates to being a foundational piece of our global economy?
Yeah. I think the hyper financialization of the built environment was something that's, you know, like triggered the last 2007-2008 mega crisis. And there's, I think, no question that things have become even more financialized and more precarious since then. You know, what happens in the future is anyone's guess. But, you know, I think in many ways, there's a really great book. It's actually sitting right next to me, but it's called In Defense of Housing by David Madden and Peter Marcuse. And they make the point that, we often talk about crises and housing crises. And so there's so much conversation about that right now, the housing crisis. Built around the precarity that you're referring to and the insane affordability challenges in cities around the world. But they make the point in this book, which is a point I agree with, that it's always in this hyper financialized capitalist modality, there is always a housing crisis. So when the next crisis with a capital C comes, it will be the system working how it is currently designed to work, right? I mean, the 2007-2008 crisis obviously had an incredibly negative impact on millions and millions of people's lives. But in parallel, it had a very, quote-unquote, positive impact on another set of people's lives. It afforded a lot of investment opportunity and you know, and in many ways, it was the system working the way in which it's currently designed to work. And so, you know, I think like we as a society like have to radically think how housing and real estate operate If we want to achieve something more equitable and not in essentially a permanent state of crisis that just becomes like radically apparent at certain moments of drops, right? But so will there be another crisis with a capital C, dramatic? Yes. When exactly it happens, I don't know. Will it be dramatic? Surely it will.
Well, we're in a crisis now with, I mean, the rental market. It is the fact that we have commodified housing to this degree and now hyper-commoditized it as a function of finance capitalism and wealth accumulation is, it is unconscionable, but you know, that's the reality we live in. I can't thank you enough, for this discussion today. Matthew Soles, associate professor of architecture at the University of British Columbia and author of Iceberg Zombies and the Ultra Thin, architecture and capitalism in the 21st century. Thank you so much, Matthew, for your time today. Really appreciated it.
Thank you so much. I really enjoyed the conversation. Have a great day.
You too. You too. All right. With that, folks, we are going to wrap up the first hour of this program, and we are going to begin our transition into the fun half. My couch writes in, not to rush or anything, but when are you going to be back in the studio? People are not loving the mic situation. We're doing the best we can. So I don't know when we'll be back in. It really just depends on when I test negative. But my 10th or my 11th day of COVID quarantine will be Wednesday. So probably still be home tomorrow, hoping to be back in on Wednesday. I just want to make sure Matt and Bradley are safe. Bradley's back from vacation tomorrow. But yeah, I mean, guys, this is the kind of the world we live in. So apologies, but
yeah, I mean, if you want it to be me doing the, keep complaining, and it's going to be the American Truck Simulator show. So,
I mean, I've heard a lot of positive feedback about that idea, Matt. So
yeah, people don't really understand what they want.
Yeah, I mean, the unwashed masses, please. But then we also have people saying, oh, away, we got to vagina land. Great. I think you sound perfectly fine, Emma. All right. Well, you know, maybe we'll take a poll. But before we do that, Matt, what is happening in the Matt Leckian media universe? I saw you had Ben Burgess on over the weekend.
Yeah, we talked about J.D. Vance, Blake Masters, and also we talked about the Trump grade a little bit. And so patreon.com/leftreckoning to get our conversation about that. And also Lillian Tchurkia, is going to be back tomorrow to talk about a very interesting conversation about abortion rights, including a sort of comparison to, say, what's going on in Europe, Germany, for instance, and also the Netherlands, who is the... I guess the gold standard over there for abortion access. But that is tomorrow night, Patreon, or yeah, just Left Reckoning on YouTube. And also we got merch, leftreckoning.com/store.
I love that hat. I don't usually wear trucker hats. Like I usually just wear regular baseball caps, but I am into that hat for sure.
We'll get you a hat. Coming okay. Right up.
Well, I'd like that very much. We'll try to take your calls. We'll see if I can do that remotely. I think we should be okay, but we'll let you know if that's not the case. 646-257-3920. We will take your calls there. Also, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, and chocolate. You can use the coupon code MAJORITY. Get a little bit off your order. All right. See you in the fun half.
3 months from now, 6 months from now, 9 months from now, and I don't think it's going to be the same as it looks like in 6 months from now, and I don't know if it's necessarily going to be better 6 months from now than it is 3 months from now, but I think around 18 months out, we're going to look back and go like, wow.
What? What is that going on?
It's nuts.
Wait a second. Hold on for a second. Emma, welcome to the program.
Hey.
Fun. Matt.
You.
Fun.
What is up, everyone?
Fun.
Nomi Keen.
You did it.
Fun.
Let's go, Brandon.
Fun. Bradley, you want to say hello?
Sorry to disappoint everyone. I'm just a random guy.
It's all the boys today.
Fundamentally false.
No, I'm sorry. Women's...
Stop. Talking for a second. Now let me finish.
Where is this coming from, dude?
But dude, you want to smoke this 7-8?
Yes.
Yes.
Is it me?
Is it me?
It is you.
Is it me? Hello, is this me?
I think it is you. Who is you? No sound. Every single freaking day. What's on your mind?
Sports. We can discuss free markets and we can discuss capitalism.
I'm going to go start
off. Libertarians.
They're so stupid, though.
Common sense says, of course.
Gobbledygook.
We fucking nailed him!
So, what's 79 plus 21?
Challenge met.
I'm positively quivering.
I believe 96, I want to say. 857-210-3501. One half. 3/8.
9/11, for instance.
$3,400. $1,900.
$5.43 trillion. Sold. It's a zero-sum game.
Actually, you're making me think less of
it. But let me say this. Poop.
You call it satire. Sam goes with satire.
On top of it all,
yeah.
My favorite part about you is just like every day, all day, like everything you do.
Without a doubt. Hey, buddy, we see you. All right, folks.
It's just the week being weeded out, obviously.
Yeah, Sundial Guns out. I don't know.
But you should know.
People just don't like to entertain ideas anymore.
I have a question. Who cares?
Our chat is enabled,
wow,
folks.
I love it.
I do love that.
Look, gotta jump. Gotta be quick. I gotta jump.
I'm losing it, bro.
2 o'clock, we're already late, and the guy's being a dick. So screw him. Sent to a gulag?
Outrageous.
Like, what is wrong with you?
Love you, bye.
Love you. Bye-bye.